NPR's new CEO, a woman named Catherine Marr. Brandon was calling her like an NPC leftist, talking about her like cis mobility privilege, criticizing Silicon Valley, and even people like you, Solana.
What to do about these people who are blocking the bridges? A very brief, publicly televised flogging. And I know that's going to sound crazy, but I'm going to break it down for you.
You shut that bridge down for like 4 hours. You know how many people shit in their car? You know what I mean?
It's called the AI Pin by Humane. This is the worst product I've ever reviewed in my entire YouTube history.
For one, it's a gay name. Like, let's just be honest. Like, what do you wear? Oh, it's a Humane AI.
What's up, guys? Welcome back to the pod. We're talking about NPR. We've got to talk about NPR. Of course, we're talking about NPR. NPR is the intersection of, I mean, multiple tech personalities now, including obviously Elon Musk jumping in there. You have sort of it looks like deranged lunatic running the company. You have people quitting, people potentially being fired, people running for competitive outlets to talk about how biased it is, et cetera. I was dropped in the middle of this controversy and obviously like started swinging. But I think we should ground you guys in the actual news of it all first. And there's no one better for that than Sajna. Tell us what actually happened rather than what happened in my sort of fevered imagination.
Yeah, I mean, so NPR, I guess the news cycle around NPR began last week when a now former senior editor, but who was then employed at the company, published a kind of tell-all, really whistleblower piece in the Free Press. So Barry Weiss is Free Press, where he basically made explicit what many people have suspected for years, which is that after or during the 2016 election and the Trump presidency, NPR was basically consumed by Trump derangement syndrome that informed every aspect of editorial decisions that were made at the company. And so this senior editor said, you know, we basically made the decision not to report on the Hunter Biden laptop story when it came out. This was something that, you know, I think NPR at the time said they weren't going to report on it because it was like not corroborated or something like that, but they didn't even pursue it. He talks about how they explicitly made the decision not to, you know, give much credence to the COVID lab leak theory, because they thought it was racist and, you know, they were sort of all in on the Fauci, you know, natural origin theory of it. And it was really just this kind of explosive piece from a guy who said, you know, I'm a self-identified liberal. I drive a Subaru. I guess he's the son of a lesbian or something like that.
I mean, he drives a Subaru. Let's be real.
Yeah.
He has inherited.
And he was saying, you know, like we lost America's trust, and it's remarkable to look at the change in the demographics of NPR listeners from like the 80s to now, when, you know, a few decades ago, you had a much more politically diverse set of Americans who was listening to this taxpayer funded media organization than you do now. So this piece came out and it sparked this sort of firestorm of criticism of NPR. The editor was suspended shortly after publication of this piece. He's since resigned. But in the meantime, journalists and activists like Chris Rufo start looking into NPR's new CEO, a woman named Catherine Marr, who was named CEO in January, but has assumed the position, I guess, last month. And what they discovered is basically a kind of archetype of, I mean, Brandon was calling her like an NPC leftist. I mean, she's basically a, what is it, like an affluent white female liberal.
Awful.
And she, yeah, she's an awful. And she, you know, she started her career in the nonprofit sector. I mean, she worked for UNICEF. She headed up the Wikimedia Foundation. She has worked in nonprofits.
She worked at Web Summit as well?
Yes.
Yeah, I think so. Her CV is kind of a laundry list of, like, I don't know, pro-censorship sort of Borg type nonprofits. I mean, she's on the board of the Signal Foundation, which, you know, has a lot of people who are sort of AI doomers. Anyway, Chris Rufo, among other people, starts digging up her old tweets and finds like this gold mine, basically, where she's sort of variously calling Trump a racist sociopath, talking about her like cis mobility privilege. She, at one point, I guess on a Zoom call, sort of says like the First Amendment is the number one challenge we face when we're fighting disinformation.
Yeah, not saving the First Amendment, the existence of the First Amendment.
Yes, the existence of the First Amendment, exactly. And that she thinks, you know, when she was at Wikimedia Foundation, she said, you know, we do think that we should be censoring and removing content we deem racist, misogynistic, transphobic, etc. So she's one of these types of people. But where we come into the story is did some digging and got some tips and find that actually she also has a long history of criticizing Silicon Valley and even people like you, Solana. She is very upset about the influence of white male Westerners like you.
I get this a lot.
But so basically, I mean, she has outlined her position against Silicon Valley most coherently, I would say, in this 2018 speech she gave in front of the Oxford Union, which is a kind of mix of like a coherent and actually interesting philosophical position, I think, where she's basically saying, you know, like these multinational publicly traded companies are able to collect personal information at scale. And this raises all of these, you know, questions about privacy and user experience. It's sort of similar to a book that came out a few years ago about like the rise of surveillance capitalism. I mean, it's a interesting argument, I think, that she's making. But then she goes on this tangent where she's like, and all these companies are run by white men who, you know, actively suppress basically the voices of women and minorities. Yeah, and you can see this in their products.
Not true. It's, to be clear, we're run by Indian men. Most of our companies are run by Indian men.
The examples she gives are like software, like voice recognition software that doesn't recognize non-native English speakers, you know, AI that has trouble recognizing darker skin tones. And she basically uses this to say, well, this AI is allowing us to, you know, this technology is allowing us to encode racism at scale. And this is one of the reasons why, you know, fundamentally we should believe that tech empires are a net negative for society. And that's sort of where her argument leaves off. And I can run through the list of her tweet stuff, but, you know,
I wish that she would have just, I mean, so the thing that I like about Timnit Gebru is she doesn't screw around. Like, she comes in and she says, no, Sam Altman is trying to genocide all black people. And I think if you're going to be crazy, just be crazy. Get in there and give us what we want. I want to take it from like the very top and just, I want to start with the dude who like a whistleblower. It's like not really I guess maybe he's a whistleblower, but the whole drama surrounding like why he like, oh, he was suspended and this is, oh, I'm clutching my pearls. How could they do that? Like, don't they care about free speech? He works for them. And he went to a competitive media outlet and trashed them. I would have fired. He would not be suspended. He would be gone. You would all be gone. Every one of you would be gone. Don't fucking forget it. I don't understand why people are pretending that's a shock. I guess I understand why people are pretending NPR being liberal is a shock, because we all have to kind of pretend. It's weird. It's like no matter what they do or how obviously biased their spin is, the story of them and of neutrality and the neutrality of our institutions is so strong in America that even in our criticism, we cling to the delusion of their neutrality. We're like, how dare you not be neutral? Like, we know they're not neutral. There's not really a surprise there. It doesn't bother me as much when it comes from like MSNBC. I don't care. Whatever. We trash MSNBC or Fox, whatever. Someone is saying something stupid, we'll go after them. But I never go after their bias. I don't mind a biased media outlet. What I mind is an outlet that purports not to be biased. And then what I really mind is being forced to pay for a media outlet. And that is, I think, really why this is even a controversy. It wouldn't matter if it was just some, like the New York Times or something, even. Like, who can we kind of know where the New York Times stands? And where they stand, by the way, is to the right of NPR. They're definitely moderate right of where National Public Radio is. But Why are we paying for them? I've never understood this. I don't understand how it's legal in a few different ways. Like, I don't know how it's not considered, you know, grossly unfair for truth-seeking outlets like PirateWires. And I also don't understand how it's not in conflict with the First Amendment in some way. It seems weird to force Americans to associate with a virulently left-wing media outlet. I don't think... I don't think that this would be a controversy were it not for that. I do think that NPR needs to be defunded. I think the era of us not talking about this is maybe finally close to over. And then maybe my last thought is just her tweets were not that controversial. Like, even the one kind of referencing, like kind of alluding to Founders Fund as being part of the KKK, I looked at that and I was like, I've seen crazy shit like that for years. What's crazy is that it's no longer tolerable. Like, she's talking about how bad the white men are, and she's talking about systemic white supremacy, and she's saying tech's a force for evil in the world because it's run by white men and all this kind of stuff. None of that, when she was tweeting it 4 years ago in 2020, she was tweeting it then as a professional who people knew, and nobody cared because the culture was so different. And like, once again, it's like another example of just how far we have really changed. And there's a question of, you know, what will come of it, if these people will be fired, if the institutions will correct themselves. I don't know. I hear really compelling arguments in both directions there. Chris Rufo actually just had a really interesting debate with Curtis Yarvin, where they sort of parsed some of this out. Yarvin believing the institutions are rotted beyond saving, and Christopher Rufo really being an idealist in this way. He thinks he can change these things. But I do just think it's interesting. Like, we are all really going in, and just the world is so different. I mean, she has not changed. It's not like she's just now crazy. This is just what America looked like 4 years ago. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that people listen to NPR so they can look down on others. Like, it's like the most elitist. Like, it's like if my mom has like a PhD, like touch. You know what I mean? Like, I don't even think we had NPR where I grew up. Like, it's just like, it's something that exists, like, if you live in a college town or a big city, and it's something that, like, upper middle class liberals listen to. And yeah, I mean, I don't even, do people actually even think that it's neutral? I've never gotten that. I think people think that PBS is kind of neutral, because if you watch like a PBS newscast, it is pretty dry. And I mean, the rest of it is just what, like Sesame Street and, you know, 36-hour Ken Burns documentaries about the Civil War or whatever. But with NPR, it's like, here's a lesbian reggaeton band based out of Toronto. And like, it's like, I don't know. It's just like kind of like Gen X hippie shit.
They say it in that breathy voice. It's like, I'm Terry Crews. NPR.
Yeah.
We're looking at the lesbian reggaeton band as she takes her Subaru to the Burning Man camp and discusses the, I don't know, endangered spotted frog and why this is actually the fault of the Western man.
Yeah, I love when Terry Gross like interviews like an annoying gay person or something, like, which
embarrassing for all of
interview,
us.
Come like, on. RuPaul. Or not RuPaul. What's that other guy, the Broadway guy? Billy.
Oh, I know who you're talking about. He like wears dresses to the events.
Yeah. And she's just like, so how did you get into theater? He was like, girl, I've always been dressing up. Like, just like going crazy on her. It's so funny. But yeah, I mean, I like NPR is like kind of soothing. Like, I used to listen to it sometimes because they would have like these fun kind of like human interest stories where they're like, we found this quirky old man who lives in, you know, New Hampshire or whatever, who blows glass. He's like interesting for no reason. But I mean, yeah, like, it's, their politics are like completely like liberal and biased. And I don't think anybody, I mean, if people are thinking otherwise, like, where have you been? Have you ever listened?
I don't know. Yeah. I think that's true today for sure. But the entire justification of NPR was that it was going to serve some vital public interest. And I still, I would love an answer as to why, because, you know, this question gets kicked up. This is not the first NPR controversy. This is not even the first NPR controversy that I've been embroiled in myself. This is, you know, part of a tradition of NPR controversies in which NPR does some dumb shit and the whole country remembers that we're paying them millions of dollars a year to do that dumb shit. And they say, I'm furious about me being forced to pay you for this. And then we just move on until the next stupid NPR controversy. I don't know if that's going to, that feels like it will happen again. You know, I don't even think they're going to fire Catherine Mayer. I mean, like she hasn't responded on Twitter. If they fire her, it sort of seems like, it seems like they're capitulating to the sort of right wing ideologues. You know, they're never going to introspect and think maybe I shouldn't be talking about, you know, over half the country in this super alienating way if I'm supposed to represent the entire country or something like that. I think we're just going to move on and it'll be like this forever. But
somebody on my timeline characterized her tweet history as an In This House tweet history, which is like very apt, I thought. It's striking how much of an NPC she appears to be. And I think the question now is like, actually this, I'm actually just kind of cribbing from this guy named Daniel Friedman. He had a very short tweet thread that I thought really put it well. And he kind of asks, like, he's like, I don't see a lot of liberals circling the wagons around Catherine. And he says, probably because a lot of them were doing the exact same thing as her between like between 2016 and 2021. So it's like, what, they're all still out there, right, with these tweet histories, and they're all probably still in positions of power. And I think, you know, the question is like, what are they going to do? Like, they, you know, they kind of just have to like put their heads down and maybe like delete their old tweets.
Yeah, these people are fucking stupid. You can delete your tweets. I don't want all my tweets from 2020 are gone.
I would be deleting my tweets from the archive. Them right now.
They are gone.
Yeah.
If I knew I said some crazy shit back then, not about that. I was actually kind of on the other side of it and went a little buck wild because I was in the grips of Adderall addiction, which is kind of going off. But like, no, if you still have tweets up from 2020, delete them.
Yeah, they should.
I don't know. I like to say some of us were on the right side of history. I was out there. I looked up. We recently had this tech mea culpa where these huge investors and famous professionals were talking about the various canceled people and how they should have done more. And one such person was Palmer Luckey. They were like, man, I should have really said something. I was saying something. I keyword searched my name, and it was like, I had like 10 likes because nobody followed me back then, but I was like, this is outrageous. But it was more, I think I was like, I attacked it in different ways. And I went after like Kara Swisher at one point for this. Like, there were people there. It's just like they were not being listened to. We were in the middle of a mass hysteria that lasted. It was like 2017 to 2021, probably. Like an actual mass hysteria. And there was just no speaking reason to anybody. And yeah, like the Catherine Mayers of the world, she was one of a million. And when is there going to be any kind of, I don't know, justice for what they did and the terror that they inflicted on people? I don't think ever, because honestly, they're still in charge. It's just they've toned things down. Like I think culture has at least shamed away the crazy speech, but those people are still in all the positions of power.
Yeah, they don't want us to. They're going to try to pretend it never happened. After they went insane on everyone, they went absolutely psychotic, and they destroyed a lot of people's lives. People like Catherine Mayer, she's the prototype of a person that was doing this in 2018. And I think what we're going to see now is that they're going to try to brush all this under the rug, downplay what they had said and what they were doing, and hope for the best. And I think it's our job to make sure it doesn't go that well for them.
To hold them to account.
Yes.
We are the journalist. We are the media now. I want to talk about what to do about these people who are blocking the bridges of America. I was in San Francisco just a couple of days ago, and I was on the day, it was like the Palestine protesters, like Day of Outrage or whatever it was, Day of Look at Me, and they closed bridges around the country and airports, and I think there was stuff abroad in Europe too, and they were all just like very mad. A day later, sort of in a dollar short, they tried to fuck up Google and got arrested and now are all fired, but that's a separate story. I want to focus on the narrow question of crazy left-wing activists, or let's just say crazy activists of any kind, of any political stripe, blocking a bridge. I think that there are like, there's a distinction, an important distinction to be made here. You have people who are just protesting in an annoying way about things that maybe you don't agree with. And that can take place in the streets of New York City. And you're like, oh, I hate them. Shut up. Leave me alone. Whatever. Then you have blocking a vital throughway in a major city. In the case of the Golden Gate Bridge, you're connecting Marin County to San Francisco. There are any number of things that are happening on that bridge, from either ambulances passing, someone could be needing to get into a hospital. The last time for sure I know, there was an organ delivery happening. It was fine. Everything worked out. But like, this is like, important things happen on this bridge. And that's separate from the question of like false imprisonment. And if you're stuck on a bridge and there are people behind you and now you can't get out and you're there for 5 hours, that's illegal. People have gone to jail for this in the past. Now, every time the bridge protests happen, and they're happening now in greater frequency because it's a meme, it's a successful meme, they actually get a lot of attention. We all talk about them because we're totally outraged. I would say if I were going to steel man the Palestinian side here, they think that people need to know about this thing, and they think that nobody knows about it. And so when someone says, hey, idiot, you're just going to piss people off, you're not going to convert people to your cause, they don't care about converting people to their cause. They just want the attention on the issue. That's the whole entire goal. And then I would say what's really happening is they want the attention on themselves. Their identity as someone who is doing good things is very important. And the idea of them getting arrested is part of that. The idea of them going to prison potentially is part of that. So now when everyone's like, what do we do to stop this? We've got to start throwing people in jail. These people were arrested. The first thing they'll say is these people need to be arrested. Most people don't even realize that they were all arrested. They were as quickly as they could possibly be arrested and removed. They were arrested and removed. This always happens. Now they're going to be charged. This one was pretty serious, so they'll probably be in charge with false imprisonment. People are already, there's a link you can follow to, if you were on the bridge, to actually petition for this. We are looking at a situation in which these people are going to go to prison, and many people are like, great, we want more prison. I don't think that's going to end the bridge protests in the first place. And in the second, I think that's pretty harsh. I am a criminal justice advocate, and I think that all of these people should be given an option between, 5 to 7 years in prison or whatever it is for false imprisonment and attempted murder, and a very brief publicly televised flogging. And I know that's going to sound crazy, but I'm going to break it down for you. So what is flogging? I mean, fully, like, you're strapped to a pole and you're just like spanked in front of people. And I think it should happen every third Friday of the month. There should be, the PBS should broadcast the national flogging, and all of the people that month who did bridge protests and, or something of this nature, we could probably have a handful of crimes in this category, who have accepted flogging rather than prison, will be flogged. And the great thing about this, separate from the fact that it keeps these people out of prison, which is so barbaric, and I can't believe that people are still advocating for such things in 2024, separate from freeing them of that fate, you're confronting the meme responsible for the protests directly. So now, instead of perpetuating the myth of these people as these heroic freedom fighters who are like fearless and I'm going to jail, it's shattered because they're not going to jail. They're free to walk around the next day if they can, following the flogging. That's replaced with the image of them like sort of crying and with their pants around their ankles, which is buffoonish and fun. And I think people will start looking forward to bridge protests rather than dreading them, so they can get to the flogging of these people who they hate, which, that desire alone ends the bridge protests once and for all. I've solved the problem. I genuinely believe this, but I know it's controversial. I would like to hear your perspective.
The public flogging is very Arab. The Arabs are like really into that. So maybe
we did it. Americans did it in this country. I looked into flogging. Americans have been doing. So the idea also, I think we have this idea. It's like, oh my God, we could never do. We did do that for thousands of years, straight up until like 1950, I think was the last flogging. Like there have been floggings. All of our founding fathers, they were down with flogging. They didn't like cruel, unusual punishment. They did not consider flogging a cruel or unusual punishment. It's not just Arab. It's Western. It's super. It's like every country in the world has had some form of this. And I think we got to get back to shaming, to public shaming. Or I think at least, I don't know if we got to get back to it. I would like to talk about it.
Just to be clear in your idea, Solane, you're talking about not whipping them with an actual bullwhip, but pulling down their pants and like bare hand to bare ass spanking.
I don't like I think probably like a wooden paddle.
Okay, there are places you can get that done in San Francisco.
Yeah, they'll do it for free. Fulton Street Fair. Like, why are we pretending this is shocking? They're doing it out there in a public parade. Like, we can do public flogging. I think a whip is too much. No permanent. I don't want them permanently, you know, maimed. That would be crazy. But I think pants around the ankles, like mortifying, very painful, and like they should be crying and mostly out of embarrassment, but mostly out of embarrassment, not pain. You know,
it was spanked in the belt as a child. That's like pretty.
Yeah, but that's illegal now. I'm saying we got to bring some version of that back.
I don't think is that illegal.
I think it's illegal to hit your kids.
Is it not? Depends on the state.
Yeah. I grew up in Texas. They like electrocute mentally disabled people. I don't think that they're.
So I hope like for spank your kids. Capital punishment.
Yeah, I think
you got like 70 IQ and they're like trial.
Corporal punishment was still allowed in schools in Alabama. I think up until. Very recently.
It was allowed in schools in Texas when I was in school. I was spanked in school.
There's no way that you were.
I was in the sixth grade because I got into a fight with another kid.
Was it a religious private school?
No, it was a public school.
That's shocking to me.
I know growing up.
Not a big deal.
I knew about schools that were taught where the teachers were nuns, Catholic schools.
Yeah, my parents both went to one.
Yeah, and they would like hit their knuckles with a ruler or other sort of physical forms of punishment. But I had never heard that in a public school before.
I mean, I'm looking at a map right now. If you look up school corporal punishment in the United States on Wikipedia, it's pretty shocking.
I'm not telling you, this is normal. Like,
it's legal in Texas. Yeah. It's legal in public schools in Texas still. Yeah, as of December 2023. It's legal in Florida. It's legal in a bunch of states. Yeah. So
that's why they're so well
Matt
behaved.
Can put up the map, but it's I remember talking about this.
If we can beat children for talking in class, we can definitely flog a deranged barista for blocking the Golden Gate Bridge. I think it's perfectly reasonable. But Sanjana, you were about to say that you disagreed.
Well, no. I don't actually know where I stand. I agree that it's clear that whatever our current approach is to arresting these people is not working because, I mean, for example, in San Francisco, the Bay Bridge protesters who you were talking about who, you know, they were charged with like false imprisonment, refusal to comply with a peace officer, tons of charges that could have at least theoretically landed them in prison for a year. And recently it was announced that they got out of trial.
Wait, you're talking about the ones before this last one?
Yes, this was November. Like... Yeah, so it's analogous. It was the same thing that happened this time, just the Bay Bridge instead of the Golden Gate Bridge. They were arrested. They were charged. The district attorney sort of exceptionally decided to pursue the charges. And they basically got off with a slap on the wrist. I mean, they have to pay like $50 of restitution and they do a few hours of community service and they're not even going to trial.
I didn't realize. I didn't realize they were already out because that one seemed serious. Everyone was so, that one really evoked fury in the city. And I thought, especially because they were going to prosecute, I thought for sure this was going to be different.
Yeah, no, everyone did. I mean, it was shocking. Brooke Jenkins was like the only DA in the country who was doing this. Or at least in a blue state. And they just basically walked away and also got a lot of earned media from the whole thing, which is, you know, they called themselves the Bay Bridge 78 and they like got all these, they had these rallies in their honor. So I agree that arresting is not working. My only concern, well, I guess one of my concerns with flogging is just, I don't actually know if I agree that it wouldn't make them like martyrs, basically. I mean, like, you know, it wouldn't sort of benefit their public image in some way, right? Because you're saying it's going to be embarrassing for them and they're not going to be able to capitalize on it the way they capitalize on like their arrest photos and stuff.
Let's tease it out. what happened? People hate these people. Like I hate these people. Yeah. Imagine you see like, I don't know, what's a good name for one of these? Like Sparkle Butterfly. It's a boy. And he's got like, I don't know, weird tattoo, weird piercings and like a puffy blue hair thing. And he was just screaming on the bridge. And there was like a pregnant mom trying to get through. And he wouldn't move because he was like, fuck you, you're participating in genocide. Then he gets arrested. Then we, the public, are given a date. And they're like, hey, like, you're going to get the chance to see Sparkle Butterfly get flogged. It's going to be on Friday at 4 o'clock. Get your popcorn ready. I will fucking be there, right? I'm going to be there. I'm going to watch it. I'll be live streaming with my friends. We'll have a drink. We'll be laughing about it. But also, Sparkle Butterfly is going to end up on like a leaderboard of like the funniest reactions to getting flogged. And now a big part of their story online is not that there are these people protesting. It's like, look at Sparkle Butterfly cry while getting spanked by a cop. And I think that is memetically powerful. And I think that it will change the way that we do these things. I think that the policing element of it, it's like, if it's, no one's actually scared of the cops, it's all theater. So you have to find some like competitive story within that framework that it's not like you really want to disincentivize them with the spanking. You want to change. You want them to be afraid of the way they'll be remembered. And I genuinely think there's something in that. Now, I actually had read, so there was a book that I was recommended a while back called, and I should plug it, In Defense of Flogging by Peter Moskos. Never actually read it, but it was summarized to me. And so that was like sort of bopping around in my head. Just the idea that you could introduce such a bizarre concept, such an apparently bizarre concept, and then sit with it. Like, well, wait a minute. What is the place that something like this used to fill in culture? And maybe what happens to culture once the shame-based solution to punishment is gone? But anyway, I think that fear would actually stop. I do believe that it would stop people from doing it, much more so than even the threat of prison time, which anyway, we're not even doing.
If you talk to these people, they actually think it's like a victimless crime. And I just want to be like, you shut that bridge down for like 4 hours. You know how many people shit in their car? You know what I mean? Like, that's all I can think about, just as like somebody who's like been, you know, like, okay, I'm like on Google Maps. I'm like, okay, I'm 5 minutes from 7-Eleven. I can make it. And then you pull up and people are like chanting about, you know, war crimes. And then you just shit in your car. And those people are not coming forward because it's embarrassing, but they're the real victims here. And so if there is a flogging, I would like, we can put them in like hoods or something and like distort their voices. But I think we need like expert testimony. Like, you made me I shit in a plastic bag.
Oh my God, like the trial before the flogging. Yeah, I agree. That's awesome. And I agree. Yeah, conceal their identities, but let them give testimony. That's like, such a good idea.
Like, kids watch me shit in a bag. They won't look me in the eye. Like, you know what I mean?
That's a traumatic memory. Yeah. The other thing that we could do is just actually pull the protesters off the road.
Yeah, like they did in Florida.
No, maybe we start there. Yeah.
Well, I wonder. I don't want to. I know it's easy to dunk on San Francisco, but that I think that it was pretty dangerous. Like you had a full. So you had, first of all, it's a bridge. It's different than in Florida and Miami, or I think it was Miami, where I saw the footage. It was like a regular giant road. There was places to pull them. It was a very different situation than you're on a narrow bridge, or relatively narrow space. You have three. They drove three cars up, locked them, chained them together. Then in front of those cars, they chained themselves, and they put their arms in these like weird barrier things. So like, they've really set it up in such a way as you could not remove them without doing serious damage to them, which is a very like terroristy way of doing it. It's like, you know, they're preying on our innate goodness not to harm them. They know the system is good enough not to actually deal with them the way, like, I mean, any non-democratic society would deal with them. I don't know. I don't think it was so easy as just removing them, because they also removed them much quicker last time on the Bay Bridge. This is like within, you know, an hour it's done. My sense, and I'd have to dig into all the details here, but my sense from what I heard from people on the actual bridge and from just the coverage of the way this went down and how long it took, that it was actually very hard this time.
Isn't there, Sanji, I think you know about this, but aren't there's legal structure in place that prevents cops from removing protesters in San Francisco and in New York? Or do I have that wrong?
Just in New York. I mean, in New York, yeah. You're talking about the ACLU settlement. I mean, there was basically, so a lot of this comes back to the Floyd protests, but basically after, in the aftermath of the Floyd riots and looting in Manhattan, the ACLU sued, I think they sued NYPD for like mistreatment of the rioters. And they won a settlement with the police department, which basically implements it. Requires the police department follows this very convoluted, like multi-tier system whenever they're responding to a protest, where they basically have to get approval from these designated like protest, like officers who
like
sort
observers,
of
observers. Yeah.
Yeah. Observers or whatever. Before they arrest people, they have to get permission before they move people off the road. So there's this kind of convoluted system, but that's in New York. San Francisco, as far as I know, doesn't have something like that. But I think in the Golden Gate Bridge situation, it was definitely logistically challenging to get them off because they also throw their keys into the ocean or the bay. That's like their tactic. They're not like leaving their keys in the ignition to facilitate the removal of the cars. They're
it's also such a funny tow truck. I mean, get a few tow trucks, drive them up, and.
Right, but to get the tow truck onto the Golden Gate Bridge when there's already cars. I mean, it's doable, obviously. Yeah, they did it in a few hours, but it's, yeah.
The idea of them throwing the keys into the bay as well, though, just further drives home the fact that all of this is narrative driven. Like, they could easily just hide the key in the back of their car, like, tell people that they're, like, they don't have to actually do that. They're doing it because of the character of themselves that lives inside their own head and the story they're trying to project to the world about who they are and what they're doing. And so the only way that you're going to fight something that is just so entirely narrative based is with a competing powerful narrative. They're heroes. The only way to change this is to make them look like clowns. And we don't do that enough. I heard that. Anyway, we could go on about flogging forever. I certainly could. Got a lot of pushback. He was like, we should do prison. We should do, actually, what about all of the hours that every single person there lost times what they get paid in their salary? And these few people should be forced to pay. We're talking like millions of dollars for them for, you know, a deranged, unless they're maybe, I mean, a lot of them probably have family money, but if they don't, it's like life ending money. I think it's interesting that we think that those two things, like, why do we think that those two things are less severe than a brief 5-minute spanking, like public spanking? And I think it's because culturally, and I know I've been joking on here to a certain extent. I mean, I still think this should be an option, but I mean, I'm playing with it. But I do think it's interesting how like shocking the idea of public shame is to us now. We are really a quite shameless culture. And that is a very recent phenomenon that we've become so shameless. That used to be a very big part of what we were. It wasn't our only thing, but it was one of the pillars of society, was trying to avoid this kind of shaming, this public shaming. And it's just completely gone now. In fact, you have the opposite. River, you alluded to, you know, San Franciscans flogging each other for fun at Folsom Street Fair. A celebration of shamelessness. It's like it's really the opposite of shame culture. I mean, it's pride culture, right? It's like, no, I'm not shamed. I'm proud. You know, I don't know where that came from, but I do feel that has a sort of larger impact probably on the way that we do things and the way that our society functions than we maybe even give it, maybe even believe. I don't know.
Yeah, somebody told me one time that the reason that they have Folsom is because gay guys invented it so that the Castro wouldn't become gentrified. And I'm like, how'd that fucking work?
It's like, now we've got an army of queer women who are actually just dating men. I am watching Vanderpump Rules right now. Don't make fun of me for this. Don't hate me for this. Don't judge me for this. It just, reality television is important and I'm lazy. And sometimes I just need my brain to turn off. And I'm encountering this drama in which one of the characters has, or one of the people, two of them are having a wedding, and their pastor, because he's a real Christian, has problem with gay people. And of course, these people all live in West Hollywood, and it's like a huge scandal that the pastor of these people who lives in Kentucky, and their wedding is going to be in Kentucky, that pastor has said things about gay people. They all get mad. And the two people who lead the charge, one is a bisexual woman who recently has come out and come to terms with her bisexuality while in a relationship with a man who she's still with, who is the other person leading the charge. And he's doing so on behalf of his bisexual girlfriend, who, again, is dating a man, him. It's like these two, it's a straight couple who are appalled, personally offended, not just like, this is bad for these other, they're talking about their own personal offense here. Well, you know who got a public flogging this week was, or sort of de facto, like a virtual public flogging, was Humane AI. Brandon, tell us the drama.
Sure. just for readers who don't know, or sorry, listeners who don't know what Humane AI is, it is a wearable AI device that's sort of part of this first heat of companies making attempts at taking AI from the laptop and the phone and getting it onto a device. It's called the AI Pin by Humane. Basically, what it is it's a multimodal AI that you can talk to and it will speak back to you. So it's like auditory, and it's also visual. So it has a projector and it projects onto your hand if you want to look at its results. And the way that you can control it with the projector is you have these sort of intuitive hand movements that allow you to scroll through different options or show different things that you want to see, such as like the time of day, the temperature outside, or whatever it is. There's been kind of a long hype cycle around Humane. It's been like, I covered it in the White Pill Gift Guide. Now we're talking six months or so ago, but it recently hit the market and people are starting to finally get it and be able to use it. And the feedback and the reviews have been like pretty much overwhelmingly negative. And most recently, this very, very big YouTube tech reviewer called Marcus Brownlee, he put out a review that was titled something like, "This is the worst product I've ever reviewed in my entire YouTube history." I watched the video, and he's very fair with his review. The title is you know, kind of clickbait. But he justifies the title with how he criticizes the device. And he ultimately lands on this point where he's like, look, like smartphones are not going away and this device is not disrupting that format yet. So that's kind of the controversy. Like it's sort of sad to see. I intuitively like want Humane to win because they're really casting right now for a different format and they've come up with something. And it also, I wanted to say, reminds me of, I don't, maybe Solana, you remember this, our older listeners will remember when we were transitioning from like Walkman and Discman to the iPhone. There was all these like for 10 years, what we did was we went to this like, funny format of like a MP3 player, pretty much. I remember I had a Sony mini disc player. The market couldn't decide the best format for a device that played MP3s. Ultimately, we landed on the iPod, which turned into the iPhone. But I feel like we're in that period right now with the AI device. Like we can't quite figure out how to get the AI off of our laptops into something that feeds the AI to us like all the time. But people like Humane, companies like Humane are like the early players, like trying to figure this thing out. And that's why I like Humane. Though after watching Marques's review, it does seem like not a very well designed product.
I think that's such a good point you just made about that period of time and hearkening back to that and the excitement of that. It was not just MP3s. It was tech devices broadly. I remember you had video games that were handheld that you could buy at the store for one game, like a throwaway type game that you would be like your Street Fighter thing or what, Home Alone 2. I saw a short, it was like an Instagram reel recently. They were looking at these like old phones you could get, like a giant phone, like a Hello Kitty phone, and like you picked it up and whatever. There were all these weird things you get at a Hot Topic, like just technology came in strange shapes. There were a million different kinds of phone you could get. There were, compared to the iPhone, at the same time, you had the BlackBerry was still happening, and there were other kinds of text devices and things like this. It was what we're really talking about is the world before Apple, period. And I think we forget how enormous Apple has become and how much of all of that stuff it has really swallowed up, including our computers. Apple, the Mac 20 years ago was like the cool, it was like, it had this cachet as like a thing that cool kids did. Like you work at a coffee shop, you have a Mac, I bet. Like that, it was like you were a hipster. Now it's all we have. And I agree, like it's been nice to see this. It's like, when there's an extinction event and then there's like all this evolution that happens and all these like weird fucking animals show up and like most of them go extinct, but it's like very cool for a minute. That is sort of where we are, I think. I hope, because it's like the early days of that still, but there are all sorts of interesting hardware things happening. It's still not yet that huge rush. And I can't even quite put my finger on why it's happening right now. Doesn't it kind of seem strange? It's not like there's this huge... They're not all AI based. There are other things, like they're like Soul Reader, and I mean there are a bunch of different kinds of hardware things being designed. I think it's almost just like people got bored and they want to do it, and maybe that's good enough of a reason. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I mean it's a good question. The other sort of AI wearable contenders, I think, are that it's obviously like the Apple Vision Pro, and then there's Meta's Ray-Bans, which are also very interesting looking. Marquez reviews them as well. But maybe you would include Apple Watch in that category too. Humane really feels like one of the first true AI wearables.
I hate the Apple Watch. I don't want that shit on my wrist. I don't want, it's like maybe the other oppression that I'm feeling or pressure that I'm feeling is just from the technology itself. But, you know, the phone in my pocket already feels like more of an imposition than I want. You know, I want less of an imposition on me from the technological world. I find the internet to be very exhausting. I know that I kind of uniquely live a lot of my life there, so probably everyone's different to some degree, but I was never a watch guy. I want fewer notifications.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, I think there's a couple of problems here. Like for one, Humane AI, it's a gay name. Like, let's just be honest. It's not like, what do you wear? Oh, it's a Humane AI. It's like, it's just the marketing is ugh. And it's like a ugly brooch or something. I don't know. Like, it's just like, why that? Like, why on your chest? There's just a lot of things about it that like are like aesthetically unappealing. And not even in like the ironic way that like the Apple Goon glasses were. And I don't know. I just think a lot of this shit is fucking goofy, and that's why people don't like it. And I don't, why do I need to read shit on my hand? Like, I have my phone in my hand. I don't need to, like, it just doesn't make any sense to me, frankly. Like, I think people are like, they're just like it's people are pitching things and they're like, oh, like, that sounds cool in theory. But then it's like, would you actually
make sense? I'm old enough to remember the iPhone not making sense to people. People were like, I don't need all this on my phone. What do I do? I just need it to make a call or whatever. Like, we were still living in a world where we thought calls were going to keep happening. I mean, do you? When's the last time? I don't have calls unless someone has a gun to my head. Like, that was considered, like, the iPhone was, it was like, the killer app on the iPhone was the phone still, of course. So why don't I just get a much simpler phone? And it wasn't. There was a whole behavior that we didn't realize was going to become a much bigger part of our lives. And that, I think that's the value prop for something like Humane AI, is that there is this other world of things that are going to be happening that we don't quite know about, and which I think is fair. And it's like a fair speculative thing in the world of AI. I mean, AI should conceivably change everything if it's even close to what proponents and people working on it are saying.
I think the other challenge that devices like these are trying to address is just the latency issue between the fact that you have to type with your thumbs onto an iPhone and you get an answer after that. It's much faster to speak and even faster to think your question. And now I'm referencing like Neuralink, for example. I think that is one of the challenges of our next generation of devices, is just decreasing the latency such that you don't have to type things with your thumbs. And so, yeah, I think.
Well, you can do like speech to text.
That's true.
Yeah. And yeah. I'd never used that. Like I've had a phone that can let me do that for like 5 years now. And I think I've only ever done it when I'm like driving or something, just because I don't want people to know what I'm texting. Like, I don't want to be in the grocery store. Like,
yeah. People who know, speak, it just feels weird, speak text to me. Are like always older boomers.
Yeah. Yeah. I speak text sometimes.
Boomers and zoomers, I guess.
As far as the Neuralink thing, I don't know. I don't want like, my thoughts to go direct to email.
You know, okay, what I brain mean? Cuck.
Yeah. I mean, like, I don't know. There's like, there's a reason that, like, I don't know. Like, do we really, how would that even work? Like, do you have to think send?
Or, I mean, that's, I don't not know, even, maybe well, being indecisive. Be, Neuralink, we don't have to go there, because the first thing it's doing is helping people with paralysis play chess and shit. Like, I think that's, like, we just let them do that, and then. Probably the use case, if there's a use case at all, it'll merge. I agree with, listen, I'm not trying to get microchipped, okay? Like, that's not a thing that I'm excited about right now, but I'm also not a paraplegic, thank God. And so I feel like that's an interesting thing there. There are use cases in some of this stuff. It's just, but I agree. I mean, the thing about Neuralink, it sometimes the technologists will do something that is, or create something with a story that is just sort of implicitly a little bit dystopian. That's sort of, I mean, VR is kind of that, right? We see it reflected in the fiction. It's dystopian. It's very dystopian. It's like, if a world is so good, the only possible victory for VR is that it's just as realistic as the real world. And if that's the case, then what is it but an exit from the real world, and the real world crumbles? Which actually works as a perfect segue into our final piece here, which is a piece that I wrote called Exit First Built. Couple of themes in here, and I want to just get to you guys as fast as I can, so I'll summarize them pretty quickly. First of all, check it out on Firewires. The premise of it is, well, it's really a discussion of these two concepts, or really this one debate largely in the tech industry that we've been having for years now. It feels like, really since 2020, when we first all faced the maybe just full extent to which our important and cherished institutions have kind of rotted to their core. What is a city but a series of institutions? Same thing as a country. And in the context of San Francisco, let's say, we have this debate over whether we should work there hard to fix it, which was framed as voice, or to leave, which was framed as exit. And then there are a variety of different forms of exit. One is just going to a different state. One is sort of leaving behind the world of government completely and just building companies. One, in the sort of purest instantiation, would be the concept of network states and building digital community. And like, we don't have anything in common. It's not, the problems aren't these cities or the institutions. The problem is, like, we are a different emergent class, and we have more in common with people, you know, tech workers in Nigeria than we have with like a barista in San Francisco. And that was really called into question during the Paul Graham thing, which we talked about last week. Paul Graham versus the Nation of Nigeria over the question, over the word Delve. Those people were largely tech workers. And that was the first time I started thinking, like, wait a minute. I don't have more in common with people freaking out over the word Delve than I do with, you know, a barista who I sort of disagree with in America. I'm an American. And I started really thinking about themes that we've written about here at PyroWires for a very long time. Just, you know, how do you rebuild a city where you live? I think it's like change. Basically, I think you could distill it down to, I believe change doesn't, you don't need some giant, you know, world altering strategy, like with the guy on the whiteboard, the meme of him sort of like piecing the conspiracy together. It starts on a city block and that's it. The piece I want to talk to you guys about first, so go check out that whole thing. It's a whole big thing, and we'll debate it in the chat on Friday when this is airing. I got the idea first for it, the premise that became the story, the sort of kernel, at the Museum of Natural History, which has recently taken down the statue. It was Theodore Roosevelt. So famously, there was a massive statue of Teddy Roosevelt at the museum, flanked by a black guy and like a Native American dude. And this was framed very recently as racist. And it was like, oh, there's like a racial hierarchy here, blah, 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 blah. It was created by a guy who was like super against the Trail of Tears and had, I believe that's what it was. I was looking back at him talking about the way the Native Americans were treated and whatnot, the sculptor. Clearly, this statue was designed to evoke racial harmony and unity. All throughout the museum, you see the signs of this mentality to sort of like take down our heroes and say, no, 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 we're bad. We're white supremacists, whatever. That thinking is baked in every exhibit. Let's say every exhibit that's younger than a few hundred years old. It's like either people are bad in general, white people bad specifically. I Googled their DEI manifesto that sort of precipitated this entire change at the museum. It was published in 2018. And in it, they use the word global. They say, we are a global institution. And I got to realizing, like, that is actually the key to all of this. It's not about weird and anti-human environmentalism. It's not about DEI. It's not even about Marxism. Like, what do all of these things have in common? They have in common this idea that we're not American. Like, the global perspective is not a thing. You cannot have a global perspective because you're an American. You cannot be a global institution that is located in New York City, run by Americans, funded by Americans, visited almost entirely by Americans. You are hopelessly American. There's no escaping your Americanness. All I'm really hearing when you say that you're global rather than American is that you hate yourself. And I think that that's the high level thing maybe that exists in society right now that we're all struggling with is self-hatred. And that's where maybe, I don't know, what do you guys think about? I know it's like a very sort of heady kind of concept, but I see it everywhere. What do you guys think about that?
I mean, I agree. I think that, well, I've always sort of thought that like the way that America particularly exports its like racial taxonomy to other countries and tries to impose that on countries that are, you know, have a different history than we do and a different ethnic makeup has always, it's always been weird. And it sort of has the biggest uptake among like the university educated sort of professional managerial class that probably shares the most similarities globally. I mean, this is something that people have talked about for a while, that there's this kind of rootless elite who travels all the time and doesn't really feel a particular sense of belonging to place. And they're the only people who can entertain this fantasy of like, you know, we could have a global community, right? Because, you know, we have sort of people who are ideologically like-minded around the world from us. But I mean, I would question when people talk about this, I would be interested to know who they identify as their global analogs and like where they were educated, you know, what their beliefs are. Like, I think you're going to actually find that it's a very small group of people who probably went to like similar universities. And you know, obviously most of this stuff is happening in English. So a lot of these people probably they grew up abroad, maybe went to international schools or something like that. But yeah, I do think it's a fantasy that in some ways is informed by not having like actually read a lot of history or sort of interacted with a lot of people who are not part of these, who are not constantly, you know, traveling in this way.
I think it's interesting because generally what we're talking about is sort of framed as wokeness. It's like, oh, these people who, these nasty elites who hate the common man and like they think they're better and they have all these weird, this strange language of DEI and whatnot that they impose on us. But when you framed it the way you just did, we talked about, you know, I'd be curious who they are, who they think their analogs are abroad and like what language they speak. I also thought like, well, what religion, like what God do they worship? And like, what is their, what history do they have? What do they love? Like, what are their, what cultural things do they like a lot? It's very tech. Like it, like the people who could do this are very potentially, the tech scene is as close as you could get to that in terms of shared values and whatnot. And even still, I think it's a huge divide, there's an ocean between American technologists and I think like, you know, a product manager in Lagos or something. I think it's very, very, very different culturally. It doesn't matter if they have a similar job. But in this way, like the network state concept is kind of the first, it feels a little bit woke. Like, I hate to say it, but like, it's sort of seems like a woke fantasy. in a sense. I want to be tentative there and be open to pushback, but that's kind of what it feels like now.
When you say that it's a woke fan, are you talking about like all the tech people coming together and like creating
more global community? So the idea that there are global values that are transcendent of American value, it's super anti-nationalist, the network state, fundamentally. In fact, Balaji has said like the internet is the new America and stuff like this. And what that implies, obviously, I'm not saying they have the same values as like your sort of standard woke college professor, very, very different values. But what they have in common is the belief that their community transcends borders and that they are a global community, which is like, was Marxism not the first?
That sounds like the international proletariat. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like I am not global. And global is a thing that I am making really, 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 really not. And much more so that I'm not woke, much more so that I'm not an anti-human environmentalist, much more so that I'm not a Marxist. I am not global. I am American. And I was made in America. I am fighting for America. If America goes down, I'll go down with it because where the fuck else am I going? It's like, it sounds really exhausting to start over somewhere else. This is my country. I feel that we are very different than other places and distinct. And I just think it's, not only do I think it's sort of immoral to run away that way and betray your country for some other sort of fantasy country, I think it's illogical. I don't think it's actually possible. I think the only people who pretend to not have these sorts of nationalistic values are Americans who hate themselves. There's no one in the thing that we saw last week with Nigeria was like, it was not like the Nigerians were being bad or something. It was Nigerians saying we're Nigerian and we're proud of being Nigerian, and they're petitioning for Nigerian culture broadly. There's no such thing as a global culture. There are people fighting for their own culture. And it just seemed strange to us because in America, the default state is to hate yourself. Sorry, River?
Yeah, I agree. But I also just think that hanging out with people who have the same job as you or like are in the same social class as you, even if you want to narrow that down to just tech, which are just like a subset of like the professional managerial class, or I guess like if you want to use a Marxist term, like the bourgeoisie, like as your founders. But like, to me, that's just, I don't know. Like I work in media. My husband's a bartender. Like I have friends who are like Amazon drivers, and like, and I also have people who are like publicists and like work in like media. They're writers and stuff. And it's like, it's actually interesting to have a diverse group of friends and to like be in contact with people who are outside of your like social class and social milieu, because otherwise you become very narrow and you become delusional and you start thinking that you have more in common with somebody in Nigeria than like, you know, another American guy who's like pretty similar to you in a lot of ways, but just has like a lesser paying job in a different industry. That's insane.
Yeah, or voted, even just like the difference between, I don't think the difference between, let's say, a more moderate guy who votes Biden and a more moderate guy who just tilts Trump, the difference between those two guys is nothing compared to the difference between the average Trump supporter and the average Nigerian. Like, what are we talking about here? It's just completely, it's a total delusional worldview. And the more that we pretend that that's real and give it any kind of legitimacy, I think the less we spend on ourselves and sort of rebuilding our culture and rebuilding our cultural institutions and things like this.
I think this is just symptomatic of Americans' unique denial. I think that some, like we can't have this conversation about how some cultures are actually better than other cultures. And I think that's what, like, we're not willing to say, like, I don't want to live with a bunch of people from another culture because actually like their customs and their values like kind of suck and it would not be fun to live with those people. Right. It's really easy to prove this. You know, you could say to a woman who lives here in America, who has a job in San Francisco, would you prefer to live here? Let's say one of the Google protesters, right? Would you prefer to live here or would you like to go, let's say, to Syria where you have to wear a niqab and you have to, like, literally when you're eating, you have to put your fork underneath the niqab just to get the food to your mouth underneath this thing. Which one do you prefer? You have to make the decision right now. So I think, you know, like that's what Balaji even misses, right? Like does Balaji want to have a physical location for this network?
Yeah,
state?
It leads to the idea is that it would lead, you start with online law and online community, online law, and then you find these what are they called? The states within a state.
Sovereign territories or something like that.
Charter cities. So you could do some form of a charter city or a whole ass new country on an island or something. Some version of that in that world, which we've been talking, this is like a theme that's existed since the world of seasteading where I came up. Some version of that will take place, but only after the online community. He's sort of it's a very interesting idea. He's wedding a lot of different ideas over the last 15 years in sort of like the intellectual tech spaces together to conclude in the network state. I don't know. Avoid global, build local. It's been real. See you next week.